not, it is what it is. If that means no women qualify for some combat jobs, so be it.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth informs commanders about new physical fitness requirements in the military.
For Tuesday, September 30th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Even though sports betting is allowed in dozens of states, health experts are calling for limits to prevent addiction.
You need regulation when the industry has shown an inability and an unwillingness to police itself.
Also, an iconic restaurant in San Francisco's Chinatown is out with a new cookbook that captures the family story behind House of Nanking.
Let's face it, this is our home, right? Like, we spend more time here than our actual home.
This is a house of Nanking.
House, there you go.
House of Nanking, house.
First, this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. Federal workers across the country could be furloughed at midnight. That's if Congress fails to reach a deal to keep the government open. Still, that doesn't mean the government would cease to function entirely, NPR's Andrea Hsu reports.
In a shutdown, some government functions that are not funded by Congress do continue. Social Security checks still go out. Your mail will still be delivered. Other functions considered necessary to protect life or property would also continue, but the Trump administration has not made explicitly clear what those would be. Max Steyer, the CEO of the Nonpartisan Partnership for Public Service, says the administration has already demonstrated and even threatened
to pursue an agenda that is personal to the president as opposed to in the public's interest.
Steyer warns government shutdowns make the government slower and less efficient. He says they interrupt modernization efforts and training programs and lead to a loss of talent. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
President Trump's federal intervention in Memphis has begun. That's according to a tweet from U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi. As NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports, the operation is set to include more than a dozen federal agencies and the National Guard.
Trump has said the Memphis task force is to fight crime in the city, which has some of the highest rates of violent crime in the country. Those numbers have been declining, but they're still high. Many residents in Memphis welcome the federal intervention, like 42-year-old Ronnie Davis in the northern neighborhood of Frazier.
Meet all the government agencies that we can get down here because the problem is coming overwhelming.
Davis says gun violence in particular has become so common in his neighborhood, he's almost numb to it. But others have protested, worried it will expand federal power in the city. Republican Tennessee Governor Bill Lee supports the operation and has offered the National Guard to help. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Memphis.
Wall Street is largely shrugging off worries about the potential government shutdown. U.S. markets closed up slightly for the day, finishing out their latest winning month. As NPR's Maria Aspen reports, the S&P 500 rose 0.4% today to close out its fifth straight winning month after setting a record last week.
The federal government seems headed for a shutdown tonight, but investors have had a great September. All the major U.S. stock indices rose this month, despite mounting worries about inflation, tariffs, and signs of weakness in the job market. If the government does shut down, it could be harder for investors and everyone else to get updates about how the economy is doing. The Labor Department is due to release the latest jobs report on Friday, but says that it won't release it or any other economic data while the government is closed. There are some signs that all this uncertainty is rattling investors. The price of gold, traditionally seen as a safe haven investment, has hit new record highs. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 81 points. This is NPR News from Washington. Ukraine is sending a mission to Denmark to share expertise fighting Russian drones. Europe's drone fighting technology lags far behind Ukraine and Russia, where cutting-edge drone warfare has become a reality in recent years. European leaders agreed last week to build what they called a drone wall to track and intercept drones violating their airspace. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints says it's going ahead with the dedication of its newest temple, despite the recent death of the religion's president and an attack on a church in Michigan. Colorado Public Radio's Stina Stieg reports.
This small western Colorado city will be home to the religion's 210th dedicated temple in less than 3 weeks. Spokesperson Paige Storheim says this honors the memory of President Russell M. Nelson.
This is what he would want. He'd want us to move forward and to dedicate and to
come together at our big general conference next week.
President Nelson died Saturday at the age of 101. During a 7-year term, he announced the construction of hundreds of temples worldwide. He also denounced the term Mormon, citing a divine revelation to use the full name, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. For NPR News, I'm Stina Sieg in Grand Junction, Colorado.
As the Major League Baseball postseason begins, fastballs are getting faster. The average four-seam fastball among right-handed pitchers has reached 95 miles an hour for the first time. The average velocity has increased for 7 straight seasons. A study released by the MLB last year concluded that faster pitches is leading to an increase in pitching injuries. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include 20th Century Studios, with Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, a pivotal chapter in the life of an icon, starring Jeremy Allen White and Jeremy Strong, in theaters October 24th. Tickets available now.
It is 4:06. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Cloudy tonight with temperatures 55 to 62, southeast winds 10 to 25, and tomorrow partly to mostly sunny with highs in the upper 70s to low 80s and breezy south winds up to 25 miles per hour. Looking ahead to Thursday, sunny, highs in the low to mid 80s. Thanks so much for listening to KAXE. There is more news ahead.
From NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump told hundreds of top military commanders this morning that the U.S. military would be used against the, quote, enemy from within. He pointed to Democratic-run cities, which he has long said are dangerous because of high crime rates. And Trump said this.
Together we're reawakening the warrior spirit, and this is a spirit that won and built this nation, and from the cavalry that tamed the Great Plains to the ferocious, unyielding power of Patton Bradley and the great General Douglas MacArthur, these are all great men.
Now that echoes language often used by Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who also spoke to the generals and admirals in Quantico, Virginia today. Hegseth reiterated that the purpose of the department that he leads would exclusively be, quote, warfighting. Joining us now to talk about all of this is NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. Hi, Tom.
Hey, also.
Okay, so before we get to the president, what stood out to you about the remarks from Hegseth?
I guess what he said about toughening physical fitness standards for those in combat jobs, who are talking armor, artillery, infantry, and he said he wants men and women to achieve, quote, the highest male standard in such things as, you know, lifting weights, dragging a sled that stands in for a wounded comrade, carrying an ammo box, running. So in general, more weight, more pull-ups, faster times.
Okay.
Now, there are some 600 female Marines in those jobs, roughly 3,000, 4,000 Army women in combat jobs. One Marine officer I spoke with, who's well-versed on fitness tests, estimate you could lose more than 20% of women in those jobs if they have to meet the highest male standard. Mm-hmm. The officer spoke on condition of anonymity because he's not authorized to speak publicly. Hegseth said, listen, that is not my goal. Let's listen.
If women can make it, excellent. If not, it is what it is. If that means no women qualify for some combat jobs, so be it. That is not the intent, but it could be the result. So be it.
No, Hegseth also said, Elsa, it may mean weak men don't qualify.
Sure. Okay, another thing. Hegseth has long criticized what he views as the Pentagon's quote-unquote woke culture. What did he say about that today?
Right. He said the Pentagon was the Department of Woke, and now it's the Department of War. He said he's ending the war on warriors, and saying that some were promoted for their race or gender, and those in the military will be promoted on merit. Of course, he fired the Joint Chiefs Chairman, General C.Q. Brown, the second African-American to hold the job, indicating he got the job not on merit. Even though Brown was a key figure in the defeat of the Islamic State, which happened during President Trump's first term, and Trump keeps bragging about that. Now, Hegseth also thinks overall the military has not been tough enough. Too many lawyers second-guessing troops on rules of engagement in war or bullying and hazing of troops. He also wants drill sergeants to be much more tough on recruits.
Okay, moving on to President Trump, whom I know has spoken then defended his use of U.S. troops in American cities. What exactly did he say about that?
Well, Trump said he told Defense Secretary Hegseth that the U.S. should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military, saying mostly Democratic-run cities have high crime rates. Of course, the president is sending troops to Portland, Oregon, and Chicago, taking control of those guard troops from the state governor. Now, Trump's comments were denounced by Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, top Democrat in armed services and an Army veteran. He called it dangerous, treating our own communities as war zones and our own citizens as enemies.
Well, let me ask you, Tom, I mean, how woke do you think the military is?
You know, I think it's mostly a caricature. People I've spent time with in combat zones tell me, listen, we've always had a warrior ethos. I don't know what this is about.
That is NPR's Tom Bowman. Thank you, Tom.
You're welcome.
Betting on sports is now a legal and thriving industry in 39 states, and that is alarming the public health community. Because even before sports betting took off, 1 to 2% of Americans already struggled with a gambling disorder. Karen Brown at New England Public Media has more.
When visitors walk into the MGM Casino in Springfield, Massachusetts, they may notice, off to one side, the GameSense office. That's a state program to curb problem gambling. There, an employee gives out free luggage tags to get people to stop by. They give out the gambling helpline number, and they can help customers set monthly spending limits if they want.
That's a big movement in 12 years.
Mark Vanderlinden oversees the GameSense program for Massachusetts. He says when the first casino opened, they were just starting to tackle gambling problems.
It was much more about making sure that there are brochures that are available that explained the odds of whatever game it was.
Now, gambling companies have to follow some rules, like no sports betting on Massachusetts college teams and no gambling by credit card. But there's no federal guidance or national commission like they have in other countries. So Massachusetts, like every state, is on its own to regulate the industry, especially now that sports betting apps allow you to gamble anywhere and anytime.
The sophistication and complexity of betting has become staggering.
That's U.S. Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut. He's co-sponsor of the Safe Bet Act, which would impose federal standards on sports gambling, like no advertising during live sports and no tempting bonus bet promotions.
States are unable to protect their consumers from excessive and abusive offers and sometimes misleading pitches. They simply don't have the resources or the jurisdiction.
The gambling industry is lobbying against the bill. Joe Maloney is with the American Gaming Association. He says federal rules would be a slap in the face to state regulators.
You have the potential to just dramatically, one, usurp the state's authority, and then two, freeze the industry in place.
He says the industry acknowledges that gambling is addictive for some people, which is why it developed a model called responsible gaming. That includes messages warning people to stop playing when it's no longer fun and reminding them the odds are very low.
And there's very direct messages such as you will lose money here.
But public health leaders say the industry's responsible gaming model just doesn't work.
You need regulation when the industry has shown an inability and an unwillingness to police itself.
Harry Levant studies gambling policy at Northeastern University in Boston. He says the industry approach puts all the blame and responsibility on individuals.
You can't say to a person who is struggling with addiction, well, just don't do that anymore.
Levant is recovering from a gambling addiction himself. He says it's true the industry supports treatment for compulsive gamblers, but by then, it's too late.
The moral equivalent of Big Tobacco saying, let us do whatever we want with our cigarettes as long as we pay for chemotherapy and hospice.
Instead, he says there needs to be a public health approach to prevent addiction. That means putting limits on marketing and types of gambling for everyone, not just those already in trouble. To make his case, Levant opens his laptop.
Watch this.
He plays a corporate infomercial produced by a DraftKings subsidiary. The company goes on to boast about getting more people to gamble on sports through what's called micro-betting during live games.
We drive fan engagement by making every moment of every game a betting opportunity. Automatic, algorithmic.
LeVan says that kind of engagement promotes addiction. DraftKings declined to comment. Those concerns are why Levant helped write the Safe Bet Act. But if it doesn't get through Congress, he says states need to act on their own. For example, a Massachusetts bill would create affordability checks to cap how much money some gamblers can lose. State Representative Lindsay Sabadosa is a co-sponsor.
If you're only allowed to gamble $100 a day because that's an affordable amount, you're not going to go broke. You're still going to be able to pay your rent.
Even if states pass new rules, sports betting is here to stay. But public health leaders hope that they can still stop the spread of a new kind of gambling, iGaming. That's when you can play roulette or blackjack online. So far, it's legal in 7 states. For NPR News, I'm Karen Brown in Springfield, Massachusetts.
Drivers have been rushing to snag electric vehicles this month. That's because a hefty tax credit for buying clean vehicles expires today. As NPR's Camila Domonoske reports, EV sales have been supercharged.
The federal tax credit for electric vehicles is worth up to $7,500, or up to $4,000 on a used car, and it's available as a rebate at the time of purchase. The Republican tax and spend law this summer ended that credit on September 30th. Anyone planning to buy an EV suddenly had a four-figure reason to hurry. Matt Jones is with the car buying site TrueCar.
Yeah, the past couple weeks, even in the past several days, EV sales have just exploded. It's been bonkers.
The deadline is today. And to be more precise, buyers need to have a binding contract by midnight. It's okay if the actual car doesn't get delivered until later. The Tesla website has a countdown clock ticking away the seconds until the end of the day. Jeff Iosa says his Mercedes dealership in Connecticut has been cleaned out of EVs as the deadline approaches.
I don't have any vehicles left that I could lease to someone that's interested in taking advantage of this incentive.
The tax credit comes with strict eligibility requirements for purchased vehicles, things like where the car is built or making sure the buyer's income is not over a certain limit. But on leases, anything goes. Every leased EV can get it. That loophole outraged critics of this credit because rich people could benefit. It also created huge demand for EV leases. Iosa's got some cars he could sell without the tax credit, but everybody wants that discount. And after the tax credit goes away, EV sales, well, here's Iosa's prediction.
It's kind of going off a cliff, right?
All those people who raced to buy an EV early won't be buying one in, say, October. So just like the deadline inflated sales recently, it's going to deflate them in the weeks ahead. EV sales are still expected to grow long term. Tax credit or no, there's a market for a car that's fun to drive and never needs a fill up. But that growth is projected to be slower than it would have been if the subsidy stuck around. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. It is 4:18. In just a moment, our daily dose of phenology with John Latimer. John will look back at his nature notes for this date. The Iron Range Pasty Festival is this Saturday at the Mountain Iron Community Center from 4 to 7. Enjoy pasties made from all local ingredients plus live music and local farmers market vendors. Thanks for listening to KAXE. Here's John Latimer.
On today's date, September 30th, 1985, it snowed, and it is just a precursor of what is to come. We know that we're going to have snow for most of the winter. In fact, our snow on the ground and staying on the ground date is somewhere right at the end of November, first part of December, and it's changing a little bit these days. But there's always a snowfall in October. Now, sometimes it's like the one we had in 91 when we had 30-some inches on Halloween over in Duluth. I think we had 18 inches here in Grand Rapids. But you can get out of September, early October, without snow falling. And it is one of those things that if you live in northern Minnesota, you just have to adapt. And we'll have our first snowfall, and it'll remind us of what is to come, and we'll live on in spite of it. And some of us will get out our skis and start waxing them, and others of us will think, boy, I hope that's the last snowfall until after I'm getting tired of skating on the lakes. However your situation plays out, enjoy.
Word for NPR comes from this station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in San Francisco's Chinatown, where chef Kathy Fang has spent most of her life.
I never left, basically, like within these two blocks, because it's like I was born there, my doctor was there, the restaurant is there.
Why leave? You have everything you need right here.
Mm-hmm.
Her dad, Peter Fang, couldn't agree more.
They got a food, got a medical care, in some swimming fish that they like.
Yeah, fish. Yeah.
Shrimp, everything.
Peter Fang opened a restaurant here way back in 1988, shortly after immigrating here from Shanghai. He called it House of Nanking, and for years he was the only chef and cooked every single dish in one wok. Now, House of Nanking has become an iconic restaurant. And for the first time in 37 years, the Fang family is sharing their culinary secrets in a new cookbook. And today, they're going to cook our team a few of those dishes. We make a stop at their favorite vegetable market in Chinatown to pick up ingredients.
This is just called New Asia. You can see it used to be a restaurant.
Yeah, it's got crystal chandeliers, yeah. Like six of them. Peter zips inside and makes a beeline straight for the baby ginger.
It's beautiful. Like a baby.
It's like a baby.
A baby skin.
Smooth baby skin ginger.
This is grandfather.
Right. Wrinkly and tough skin.
I know.
Peter, a man on a mission, swipes an entire shelf of roasted gluten into his basket.
Oh, my God, Peter. How many boxes are you getting?
What are you? They don't have all the time.
By the time we're leaving this market, our bags are fully loaded.
We brought dried shrimp, silk squash, wawa tai, which is baby napa cabbage, and we also got Chinese bacon.
Yummy.
This is going to be going into a few of our dishes today.
So. I can't wait. All of these ingredients feature in their new cookbook, which chronicles stories not only about their restaurant, but also about the family's struggles building it.
We're going to go up this way.
We head a few blocks down and into House of Nanking.
Right here?
And the first thing you notice when you glance at the walls is Keanu Reeves staring back at you from, like, every direction.
Peter, there's so many pictures of Keanu Reeves visiting your restaurant here. One, two, three, four, five. Six.
Because he made a movie here.
Which movie?
The new Matrix 4.
Oh!
But seriously, way before people like Keanu ever came here, times were really tough. In the early days, Peter says, this place was empty most every day and night. That is, until a review in the San Francisco Chronicle in 1989. It changed this place's fate, literally overnight, and people started lining up outside, just waiting to get in.
And then it just a boom.
Boom.
Oh, wow, people, they're waiting for you to open the door.
Was that stressful or more exciting than stressful?
Okay, both. I know it's a challenge. So first of all, you have to take these so many people, cook a lot of food. Well, I only have one wok.
Yes. Yeah, remember, there was only one wok in those days. And as a little girl, Kathy was put to work, folding napkins, filling up chili oil jars. Today, she is a full business partner with her dad, who's now 76 years old. I asked Peter to tell me what he thinks made House of Nanking such an enduring presence, in a city that's already so full of Chinese restaurants.
The basic traditional Chinese cooking philosophy, that kind of things won't change. But for the ingredients, we have to use the local ingredients to learn how to use them. And you have to study what the other people, they want. So if you cook your Shanghainese very bland food, they won't come back again. There's no right or wrong.
Right.
It's just the people like it or not dislike it.
And you think it's a good idea to adapt your cooking to please people. Because some chefs, they say, this is the way I cook. If you don't like it, you don't need to cook.
Yeah, I understand them. A lot of chefs say, I'm doing this.
I do it my way.
Yeah, I don't care you like it or you dislike.
Right.
Well, I think that's sometimes it's not right.
Your purpose is to make people happy.
Make people happy.
I would compare this to the way that we treat the dining room is the way that we would treat, like, if you invited guests to your home, because let's face it, this is our home, right? Like, we spend more time here than our actual home, right?
So, this is a house of Nanking.
House, there you go.
House of Nanking, house.
So, Kathy, what was it like to grow up around House of Nanking when you were a little girl?
I think in the very beginning, it was very exciting and new to me, right? I was seeing the restaurant getting built. My dad built all the shelves himself. So I saw something kind of come to life from nothing. And then I got to kind of experience the food that my dad was creating, how it started to evolve and change, the smells, learn how to interact with people. It was just like a very rambunctious and lively place to grow up in. And then I think, like, as I got older through high school and college, my parents knew that this was a very tough life. And they came here to give me better opportunities. So I never thought I would actually come back and do this. It wasn't until later when I did work in corporate America when I realized that this is incredibly boring, uninspiring, and what I grew up with was something that was far more exciting. So I came back.
Peter, how does it make you feel to watch your daughter do what you're doing to eventually come back and enter the restaurant business and really appreciate the way she grew up and make it a permanent part of her own life?
First of all, I'm proud of my daughter. I say that. But she is going to be better than me.
You believe she's going to be better than you?
Better than me. In many ways.
Your dad says he's so proud of you. What is it like to share his legacy with him now, to work alongside him?
The legacy aspect, I think, is very special because they were able to build an institution that, you know, has become like an icon, and I get to be a part of it, and I happen to be good at it. There's no way my dad would let me even touch this if I was, like, not good at it.
Right.
And so, yeah, I can continue it on for them.
Well, I know that, Peter, you never liked writing menus, and you are known for ordering for your guests. So will you do us the pleasure of ordering some dishes for us that we can try today?
Sure, I'd love to do that.
Kathy then dashes into the kitchen, and in mere minutes, a parade of dishes arrives at our table.
So this one is the Wawa Thai baby napa cabbage.
Wawa, yeah.
So for this one, I did it with, like, the little dried baby shrimp that we got.
Then comes flowering cauliflower speckled with Chinese bacon.
Oh, that's good. That's so good.
And never forget the restaurant's fried onion cakes with peanut sauce, delicate layers of flaky dough stuffed with scallions.
Which is like a house favorite, House of Nanking favorite.
Do you want me to put some onion cake on your plate? We eagerly scoop food onto each other's plates, making ourselves at home, just as chefs Peter and Kathy Fang have always intended.
Don't let the food get cold.
Their new cookbook is called House of Nanking, Family Recipes from San Francisco's Favorite Chinese Restaurant.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered on People Powered KAXE. Good afternoon. I'm Jennifer Barr. It is 4:29. In a few moments, national native news. And 1 hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can also find lots of local news stories and conversations at kaxe.org. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. Weather for tonight, cloudy, temperatures 55 to 62, winds from the southeast 10 to 25. And tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny, highs in the upper 70s to low 80s with breezy south winds. The Bemidji Symphony Orchestra presents the premiere of Sky Tinted Water this Saturday, 7 p.m. at Bemidji High School Auditorium. The song celebrates the 50th anniversary of Voyageurs National Park.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. It's National Truth and Reconciliation Day, also known as Orange Shirt Day, honoring the survivors and children lost in Canada's residential school system. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, on the eve of the day, a multi-million dollar settlement and an apology were announced for one northern school.
The agreement in principle is aimed at compensating the former students of the Isle of Cross boarding school, just under 300 miles north of Saskatoon.
Simply put, these schools were a mistake, and they shouldn't have existed.
The Premier of Saskatchewan, Mo Scott, went to the community on Monday.
Today, on behalf of the province of Saskatchewan, I apologize to you. And as part of this agreement, the province has agreed to pay $40.2 million to address the four major pillars of compensation under the class action that was filed.
The compensation, Mo says, is an effort to promote reconciliation, healing, wellness, education, language, culture, and commemoration in the community of Isle of La Crosse. The residential schools operated across most of Canada from the mid-1800s to the late 1900s, in an attempt to assimilate First Nations, Inuit, and Métis children into white society. It's believed about 150,000 children were forced to attend the schools. Thousands were physically, emotionally, and sexually abused. Many died. The Saskatchewan government expects the proposed settlement will be approved by the courts by early next year. I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The U.S. Interior Department has reversed a Biden administration decision to give Alaska tribes legal jurisdiction over Native allotments. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, the order could return millions of acres of land to state control and shut down the Acluna tribe's new casino near Anchorage.
This latest federal opinion attempts to restore a 1993 Interior Solicitor's opinion issued during President George W. Bush's administration. It gave the state jurisdiction over Alaska Native allotments. But last year, the Interior Solicitor in the Biden administration, Bob Anderson, issued a new interpretation of that decision. It gave jurisdiction over Native allotments to the tribes, which cleared the way for the Acluna tribe to operate a small casino on a Native allotment. Last week, the Trump administration's Deputy Secretary of the Interior overrode Anderson's opinion and instructed all department bureaus, including the National Indian Gaming Commission, to follow the 1993 opinion. Anderson now lives in Anchorage and is a visiting professor at Harvard. He says the reversal of his decision is wrong, that Native allotments in Alaska should be regulated by the tribe just as they are in the lower 48.
It's been the law in the lower 48 forever, and Alaska's part of the United States, and the same federal laws apply here as they do everywhere else. So I'm fairly confident that we'll continue to prevail on these questions.
In April, the state of Alaska sought an injunction from a federal court in Washington, D.C. to shut it down. So what happens now that the Interior Department has revoked tribal jurisdiction over Native allotments in Alaska? The state has not said what its next step will be. Patty Sullivan, communications director for the State Department of Law, said the new opinion calls for the Interior Department to reevaluate actions taken by the National Indian Gaming Commission. Alaska's Attorney General Stephen Cox applauded the decision and said it restores jurisdictional balance that Congress intended. But despite last week's opinion, the Native village of Acluna said its Chenan Gaming Hall remains open. The tribe's president, Aaron Leggett, said it will also review the opinion to clarify questions of legal jurisdiction. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com.
Now more than ever, the supporters of this and all Native One programs deserve a little extra love. Learn more about all our public radio underwriters and web-based sponsors at kawanak.org/supporters-spotlight.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. If Republicans and Democrats do not come up with a bipartisan spending agreement, the government will shut down by midnight tonight. A key political question at that point would be who gets the blame? Let's turn to NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro, who has the answers from a new NPR PBS News Marist poll out this afternoon. Hey, Domenico.
Hey, Scott.
So let's get to that key question. What did respondents tell you about who they would blame if there is a shutdown?
Well, Republicans would get more of it, but just by a 38-27% margin. No one gets a majority of the blame like Trump did in 2019 during what was the longest shutdown in history. In this survey, 31% also say they'd blame both parties equally. Here's one respondent from the poll, Deborah Sudbeck, an independent from Nebraska, who would blame both parties if there's a shutdown.
Neither one wants to compromise. It's just that Republicans want to do everything they can to antagonize the Democrats, and Democrats want to do everything they can to go against the Republicans. They're just fighting like two little kids.
Two little kids, she says. And certainly, you know, easy to feel that way, though. Not everyone blames both sides here and think that they're both the problem. Generally, in polling, Democrats have shown themselves to be more likely to want to compromise. And we saw that again here in this survey, with Democrats and independents leaning toward compromise and Republicans leaning toward standing on principle, even if it means a shutdown.
President Trump, obviously a key figure here. What did the poll say about how people are feeling about him?
Yeah, he's at just 41% approval, the lowest we've seen in the second term for Trump, but very similar to where he's been for the last decade, Scott. You know, just 31% of independents approve, but he's propped up by his base. 87% of Republicans approve of the job he's doing. Take a listen here to Dave Cole, a Republican from Colorado, and a warning, he swears in this.
He may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. And he's just like George Patton in that he doesn't always say the right things to the right people, and he doesn't say them in the right way. But boy, he knows how to win the war.
And for a lot of people who support the president, that pretty much sums it up. Obviously, though, others have very strong feelings in the opposite direction. An independent from Michigan that I talked to, for example, just flat out called Trump the, quote, worst president ever. And that's about all he wanted to say on that.
Does that mean Democrats are faring any better?
No, they're actually faring worse. I mean, they get just a 25% approval rating for Democrats in Congress, and that's largely because Democrats themselves are not in lockstep. Only about half of them approve of the job that their party is doing in Congress.
Wow.
Robert Jenkins, a Democrat from Pennsylvania, put it this way.
I think they're spineless. I really do. I think that they're getting run all over by the Republicans. It's just fight back. You know what I mean? Fight back as far as what's going on.
How do we square that then, Domenico, with people saying they would blame Republicans more if there's a potential shutdown?
Well, Republicans in Congress get a slightly better score, 35%, which is not great either. But 3/4 of Republicans approve of the job that their congressional leaders are doing. So that's key. For Democrats, this is really frustration with life in the minority. Jenkins, by the way, does not want to see the government shut down. And I think that really highlights this catch-22 that a lot of them have, wanting the party to fight, but not having many good options to stop Republicans.
That is NPR's Domenico Montanaro. My approval rating of you remains high. Domenico, thank you very much.
That's great, Scott. Me too.
Wednesday night at sundown, many Jewish people will begin their observance of Yom Kippur. It's considered the holiest day in the Jewish calendar, and it's generally a time of reflection and contemplation. This year marks the second time the high holidays have come amid the ongoing war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, a conflict that has ignited a growing ideological divide in Jewish communities. And so we wanted to know how faith leaders are thinking about all of this. We called up Rabbi Sharon Brous, who joins me now here in studio at NPR West. Welcome back to the show, Rabbi.
Thank you so much for having me, Elsa.
Well, first of all, Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Yom Kippur is, of course, a day of atonement. Observers typically fast, right, from sundown to sundown. And I wanted to ask you, as we're watching the ongoing famine in parts of Gaza, if that custom of fasting is resonating any differently with you and with your congregation this year.
So the fast on Yom Kippur is a 25-hour fast, mm-hmm. and the reason that we fast on Yom Kippur is so that we can focus our attention fully on the spiritual work of that deep soul accounting that happens. And when we think about the first pangs of hunger that come to us over the course of that day, which for me will be at 9 a.m. because I'm that kind of eater, there's no way to separate that from the ache of those who are hungry in the world, including those people in Gaza who are starving after 2 years of real devastation there. As a Jew, I am absolutely horrified by the decision that the government of the state of Israel made in the spring of 25 to seal off the Gaza Strip and restrict all humanitarian aid and food. And witnessing the devastation that that has wrought on the people of Gaza over the last several months has been absolutely heartbreaking. And that's why it is so essential to me that we use our Jewish voices to speak and to call for a different way forward. This is our work.
And that's
now
what I want to ask you about, because I'm listening to you speak so passionately about your feelings about what's happening in Gaza. How do you comfort and challenge with a divided congregation?
This is incredibly difficult, and I don't think that any community is spared of this right now because everything is so fraught. We've really worked hard over the last 21 years in our community to build a culture of respectful disagreement and curiosity and compassion so that when we don't see things the same way, because we don't want to live in a small tent environment, sure, where everybody sees things exactly the same way, we're able to sit together and challenge one another and hear one another. And at the same time, not every view and every perspective is welcome in our community, because there are people who advocate violence and there are people who work hard to dehumanize the other. Those views do not get a seat at the table in our community. So the way I've been thinking about it is we're trying to build a medium tent. That's a very important value for me as the rabbi of a community.
So how do you find a message that resonates with everyone in that medium tent, regardless of where they stand on this war?
We root in ancient wisdom and in core values. I speak about how every single person is created in God's own image. And that means that the death of any innocent is a moral catastrophe. I think that there's been a kind of atrophying of our moral muscles in this time. And I see it in my own Jewish community, in which people have been so afraid because of potential harm and real harm that has come to Jews around the world, that they've stopped speaking out when Israel's government behaves in ways that are fundamentally antithetical to our Jewish values. Our tradition's been around for thousands of years and did not survive exile and pogroms and gas chambers so that we could quiet the moral muscle the moment we have power. We need to be applying the strictest moral analysis to our own behavior. That's what our history has taught us to do, and that's what our tradition calls us to do.
Rabbi Sharon Brous, the founder of Ikar, a Jewish congregation right here in Los Angeles. Thank you so much, Rabbi, for being here.
Thank you, Elsa.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 4:44. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In a moment, North Star Stories, produced by Ampers, stories from throughout Minnesota. Support for KAXE comes from the Grand Rapids Players, presenting The Great Gatsby, October 3rd through 5th at the Rife in Grand Rapids, celebrating the 100th anniversary since its original publishing. Friday and Saturday shows at 7 and Sunday at 2. Tickets available at grplayers.com. The McCroskey Art Center's Fall Studio Tour is this Saturday from 10 to 4. There are 9 different studios with 21 participating artists. Maps can be found at the McCroskey Art Center in Grand Rapids or online at mccroskeyartcenter.org/studio-tour. Let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. It's time for North Star Stories on People Powered KAXE.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. Today in Minnesota,
the mother charged after two students overdosed at a Minnesota school. Then, as they prepare for their future, some college students in the state face food insecurity and what's being done about it. And the Duluth City Council moves to support the LGBTQIA2S+ community. I'm Gracie J. A 39-year-old mother from Cokato, about an hour west of the metro, faces felony charges after her 6-year-old daughter brought psychedelic mushroom chocolate to school, causing two children to suffer severe impairment. Wright County deputies say the girl ate chocolate labeled Meld Magic Mushroom, marked for adults only. Both children were hospitalized. Investigators searching the mother's apartment found meth, fentanyl, and drug paraphernalia within reach of children. She now faces felony charges of drug possession, child endangerment, and storing meth paraphernalia. In today's main story, as college students return to class, nearly 1 in 4 worry about where their next meal is coming from. Producer Britt Ahmet looks at the problem of food insecurity on Minnesota's college campuses and what's being done about it.
This September, tens of thousands of students return to Minnesota's colleges and universities, along with juggling rocketing tuition costs and heavy course loads. Some of them are also confronted by a mostly secret yet ever-present challenge.
I've definitely noticed how much of an impact inflation had. I pretty much figured that in order to make certain ends meet, that means I needed to intake less calories or at least pay for less calories.
David, a student at Minneapolis College, a 2-year community and technical college, faces food insecurity.
It shouldn't be that hard necessarily try to get a sandwich.
Second Harvest Heartland, a leading Minnesota hunger relief organization, did a recent survey that showed that 1 in 5 households in our state cannot afford the food it needs, and that number is even greater for college students.
It's actually 1 in 4. So that population is experiencing a greater burden of food insecurity than the general population.
Sarah Peterson is director of Kitchen Coalition, Second Harvest Heartland's prepared meals program.
A lot of college students are balancing multiple jobs to make ends meet. They might also be balancing caregiving, parenting responsibilities. So all of these things make it very hard both to get access to the food that they need and, in the case of groceries, being able to prepare that food, which takes time that these students don't have.
This past year, Kitchen Coalition supplied 125,000 meals to its 17 college partners, including Minneapolis College. They have requests for even more this year. The prepared meals are nutritionally balanced and ready to eat. But an increasing number of colleges are also opting to provide traditional food pantries on campus.
Food is one of those things often first given up because if they don't pay their rent, they can get evicted. If they don't pay gas, they can't get to college.
Heidi Gettle is director of the Student Resource Center at Minneapolis College.
Every Wednesday, 9 to 4, the pantry's open.
This fall semester, the pantry has averaged about 150 visits a week, a number that's been going up as more and more students like David find out that they can pick up staples there, milk, eggs, bread, produce, as well as prepared meals and hygiene items. Even online-only students can use the pantry. For Heidi, food access is not only about meeting a student's immediate need for a meal.
A lack of nutrition, they're not thinking as clearly, they're not able to fully participate in their classes, so it could impact their grades, which leads to financial aid difficulties if they're not passing their classes.
You can donate or get involved by contacting your local food shelf or Second Harvest Heartland at 2heartland.org. This is Britt Ahmet for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The Duluth City Council has passed a resolution recognizing the Duluth Superior LGBTQIA2S+ community and proposing a new committee to oversee related initiatives. TV station Northern News Now reports that the measure passed 7-2 after a lengthy debate, despite concerns about the city's $7 million budget deficit and a possible tax levy increase. Supporters argue that it will facilitate policy reviews, raise awareness, and combat discrimination.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the State of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. President Trump's federal intervention in Memphis to fight crime has begun. The operation is set to include more than a dozen federal agencies and the National Guard. Trump has also said that he is sending National Guard troops into several other cities like Portland, Oregon, to protect federal immigration facilities. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf has been watching all of this and joins us now from Memphis. Hi, Kat.
Hi there.
Okay, so tell us more about the operation you're seeing out there. It started today, right?
Yeah, U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi tweeted today that it had begun, saying 9 arrests had been made and that a joint operation center is up and running. She wrote, quote, "We're just getting started." That said, it doesn't feel different in the city today. I was driving around all over and didn't see any signs of the operation myself. Tennessee Republican Governor Bill Lee has said that this will be a slow rollout and that it'll last for weeks, maybe months.
Maybe months. Okay, well, what have you been hearing from residents there?
A majority of the folks I talked to today told me they support federal intervention in the city, even though that doesn't necessarily mean they support Trump, but they welcome any help they can get. Memphis has one of the highest violent crime rates in the country, and while those numbers have been decreasing recently, they're still high. I was in the northern neighborhood of Frazier this morning, and people there told me they're just exhausted by it, particularly the gun violence. Here's 39-year-old Marcus Rogers. He's an Army veteran who's lived here all his life, and he told me he hopes having troops and federal officers on the streets might give people a much-needed sense of security.
It's not even safe going to get groceries, going to get a carton of egg today. It is not safe. We needed some, for sure.
But others here have been protesting it, worried this will expand federal power in the city.
Okay, well, as we mentioned, all of this comes as President Trump has been sending or threatening to send National Guard troops to several other cities. I mean, it almost seems like a different city is mentioned each day.
Yeah.
What kind of patterns are you seeing, Kat, in the cities that Trump is targeting?
Yeah, one major pattern is whether the governors of each state agree with the move. So far, this has fallen entirely along party lines. In D.C., where National Guard troops have been deployed for more than a month, Trump has the authority to deploy them. But in states, the National Guard is ultimately under the control of the governor. So here in Tennessee, Republican Governor Bill Lee has signed off on the deployment. The governor of Louisiana, who's also a Republican, just today requested National Guard troops to be deployed in his state as well, also to fight crime. But then there's the places like Portland, Oregon, and also Chicago, which Trump has threatened, or L.A., where Trump did send the National Guard earlier this year. In all those cases, it has been done against the wishes of the Democratic governors of those states. It's an unusual move and legally questionable. There's also a larger pattern here, and that's the normalization of armed, uniformed troops on U.S. streets, which legal experts at places like the ACLU worry is challenging this long history in the U.S. of limiting the role of the military domestically.
That is NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Memphis. Thank you so much, Kat.
Thank you.
In February, the Trump administration designated several drug cartels and gangs as foreign terrorist organizations. This month, the U.S. conducted military strikes in the Caribbean against what it says were drug boats. This is part of its campaign against cartels. Officials have likened that effort to the U.S. campaign against Islamic extremists during the global war on terrorism. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas reports.
At a recent hearing on Capitol Hill, FBI Director Kash Patel celebrated the Trump administration's decision to label drug cartels as foreign terrorist groups.
We must treat them like the foreign terrorist organizations post 9/11. We must treat them like the Al-Qaeda's of the world because that's how we're operating.
Going after the cartels with law enforcement, Patel said, has failed to destroy them. To do that, he said, the U.S. needs to bring in its military and spy agencies.
In order to eliminate, and that's the key, eliminate the drug trade, we have to use authorities at the Department of War and the intelligence community to go after the threat like we did terrorists when we were manhunting them.
The administration has provided few details on the scope of its anti-cartel campaign, but it has trumpeted its military strikes, three and counting, against suspected drug boats in the Caribbean. After the first one, President Trump posted online a black and white video that shows a fast boat bursting into flames. He said 11 suspected members of the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua were killed, but the administration has not provided any evidence to support its claims about who and what were on the boat. After the second strike, Trump was asked about providing proof that the boat was indeed carrying drugs and posed a threat to the United States.
We have proof. All you have to do is look at the cargo that was, like, it's spattered all over the ocean. Big bags of cocaine and fentanyl all over the place.
He also said they have recorded evidence but did not elaborate. The Trump administration has said the president took action under his Article II powers as commander-in-chief and in self-defense. But experts and some lawmakers have condemned the strikes on civilian narco traffickers as illegal extrajudicial killings. Luca Trenta is a professor at Swansea University in the UK, where he studies U.S. foreign policy and covert action. He says the recent military strikes represent a massive escalation in the use of force and suggests the U.S. president can target whomever, whenever he wants, without making an effort to provide a legal justification.
It's a really bad thing if the president of the United States can decide that a group of civilians that might pose some kind of remote threat can be killed without any form of due process, because who is to say what group will be targeted next?
During the war on terror, the U.S. targeted al-Qaeda and other jihadi groups under the legal authority passed by Congress after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. The U.S. conducted strikes in active conflict zones, but administrations also stretched that authority to target groups outside those areas if they were deemed a military threat to the U.S., Trenta says.
None of this would apply to the current situation due to the nature of the target and the lack of a threat that the target was posing.
In the case of the first strike in the Caribbean, an individual briefed on the attack and not authorized to speak publicly told NPR the boat had turned around and was returning to shore when it was hit, raising further questions about how it could have posed a direct threat to the United States. The legal issues aside, there are also questions about how effective the war on terrorism blueprint of military strikes will be against cartels. Vonda Feldbab-Brown is a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution.
I'm very skeptical that concentrating lethal action in the Caribbean will stop the flow of drugs to the United States.
The administration has said its military strikes could deter cartels from trafficking drugs to the U.S., but Feldbab-Brown says drug traffickers have not been deterred by the already significant risks they face, including death or a long prison sentence. She also notes that there's an opportunity cost to blowing up drug boats instead of interdicting them, seizing the cargo, arresting and questioning crew, as the U.S. has done for decades.
And I would say that there is a real downside to the lethal strikes, which is big losses of intelligence that one can obtain from being able to interrogate detainees.
To interrogate the drug mules about the larger networks they work for, and then putting that intelligence to good use. Then there are also a slew of possible ripple effects from the administration's use of military force. The potential spike in violence as criminal groups shift to land-based smuggling routes, sparking turf wars, to the potential for public backlash if, as happened in the war on terror, U.S. strikes kill innocent civilians. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
You are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Focus Features, presenting Anemone, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. Two brothers wrestle with their past and the one secret that has kept them apart for decades. Anemone, rated R, in theaters Friday. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Workday, Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people, money, and agents today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. and from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It is just before 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. Support comes from the First National Bank of Coleraine since 1906, serving the needs of the community and working with their friends and neighbors with branches in Coleraine and Grand Rapids. More information at coleranebank.com, member FDIC. Weather for tonight, mostly cloudy, temperatures 55 to 62, winds from the southeast 10 to 25, and tomorrow partly to mostly sunny.